Well, you may see a picture up there that has a rock in the middle of the road. That's pretty good indicator of some of the kinds of challenges that we face as believers as we're wanting to share the gospel. There are obstacles to reception, and sometimes it's encouraging, and maybe somewhat discouraging, that people, even when they were confronted directly by Christ himself, still didn't respond, which is perhaps hard for us to even imagine. So let's back up just a little bit. Last time we looked at the sixth chapter of John's Gospel, as we've been studying through the Gospel of John. And this chapter has been known as the Bread of Life Discourse. And it includes the feeding of the 5,000 and this walking on the water of the Sea of Galilee. And after these events, he spent some time in Capernaum. But those events gave a basis for what was being talked about. The discourse was occasioned by those events that preceded it. And you can see where the matter of feeding bread to the crowd, and they thought that was pretty nice to be able to go and get a free meal. And you have to think that whatever the bread was like that Jesus created was probably at least as good as, if not better than, any other bread they've had. I hadn't really thought a whole lot about that before, but you might imagine. So they may be thinking, well, this is pretty good. Let's follow this guy and get some more of this bread. So at Capernaum, Jesus spoke with a number of people. There may have been a mix of people at different times. But after the discourse, the people, many of them, stopped following him, because they didn't understand the analogy that he was making about his being the bread of life. They tended to take his words quite literally when he referred to them eating his flesh and drinking his blood, instead of recognizing that this was a call for their total embracement of him in personal faith as the Son of God, as Messiah. So we can look back on that and say, well, why didn't you get that? But they were in that moment, and they were focused on the literal and didn't catch the analogy, which should have been recognized, because the terminology that was used earlier was comparable. So next, the scene is going to move to Jerusalem, but there's some discussion that's going to take place before they get there. So just to give us a little bit of background on that, so there is that movement that's going to be taking place here. So as we look at this next section, we want to think about the challenge of unbelief close to home. Now, there are probably many of us who can relate to that, because we deal with people around us who are close to us, often in families or other kinds of relationships, and we see that as a bit of a challenge. So looking at the first couple of verses here, after these things Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. So he had some experience in Judea previously that is on his mind as he's thinking about this. And then we have that additional statement, now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. So we want to think about, what does all of this mean? Well, first observation we want to think about is, some places have more opposition to ministry, and you could put, than others. We recognize that. We see that all around us in our whole world. We can look at some places that where there's greater reception, other places not so much. And so this was something that was a very tangible matter in this particular situation. The threat to safety was more serious in Judea than in Galilee. Jesus generally spent more time in Galilee than in Judea. He grew up in Galilee, in the Galilee area, in Nazareth. Then he moved his headquarters, as he began his public ministry, to Capernaum. And we have various texts, particularly in the synoptics, that talk about what was going on there. The main occasions that would bring him to Jerusalem or to the Judea area would have been for the various feasts that would come along, and we have reference to at least three Passovers, and of course here to the Feast of Tabernacles. And John doesn't give a lot of attention to this later Galilean ministry. He kind of just gives a brief reference, sort of in passing, in comparison to what the other Gospels give, like Matthew 12 through 17 and chapter 21 deal with some more of these events that would have taken about a six-month period. And then we also note, over this time frame, there was a rise in hostility and opposition to Jesus in some places more than others, as the word gets around. And even in the account in John chapter 6, where he gives the bread of life discourse, there was reaction to him because they didn't pick up on the analogy he was communicating. And so instead of following him, they sort of fell away with regard to many of them, at least. Then there's the reference to the particular feast here. The timing of the next Jewish feast created a dilemma. He would have wanted to go up to Jerusalem because that was the normal thing to do. The Feast of Tabernacles would have occurred about 6 months after Passover that had been referenced in chapter 6, verse 4. In that particular year, the Feast of Tabernacles would have fallen on September the 10th through the 17th of A.D. 32. So if you're picturing the timeline that you have in your head, you're putting that right where that needs to be. This was the time of the fall grape and olive harvest, and that would have been celebrated around this time. Exodus 23, Leviticus 23, Deuteronomy 16 give some background to this if you were wanting to look into that further. In Jesus' day, this was probably the most popular of the three required Jewish feasts. It was one that was had sort of a joyous emphasis because it commemorated the sojourns in the wilderness, but they weren't there now. They were out of it. So it was sort of a time of looking back and thinking, well, we're glad that's over with. We've moved on. But they would build these temporary shelters out of branches and live in them for a week. Still goes on today. I had noticed in the prayer letter from the Chosen People Ministries that just had come out, a reference to the Feast of Tabernacles, and you could see it in around New York where people would build their little huts. So it's still something that is celebrated today among the Jewish people. So this particular feast would be one that would have been required of the men to personally attend in Jerusalem, and so it was one, there was an allurement to want to go and be a part of that, to do as one was supposed to do, but also to enjoy the benefits of that particular time, and Jerusalem was a place where that was particularly focused on doing. So, but the problem was there was an increase in opposition because of the previous visit that Jesus had made there. And so this decision to travel was now a little bit more of a serious concern. Looking then at the next few verses here, verses 3 to 5, we read, "His brothers therefore said to him, 'Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world.' And for even his brothers did not believe in him." Now that's a startling statement there. Jesus' own brothers didn't believe in him? So let's think about this for a moment. We readily recognize that some who are closest are more resistant to believe. In many families, that has been the experience. Jesus' brothers gave practical advice for more popularity. They are looking at Jesus and they're looking as outsiders, those who didn't trust in him, to recognize fully who he was. They knew him as their half-brother. They suggested that he go up to the feast to support the remaining disciples that were there, because he had been there before, and so their thinking is, well, hey, if you want to start a movement, because that's what they're thinking he's trying to do, well, you need to get back there and stir up some interest and get some greater support going here. Because their thought was, well, these people need to see that you are continuing this work, and in order to stay convinced, you need to get back there. They were essentially acting as his managers. I don't know if you've thought about that, but did Jesus need managers to show him this is what you ought to do? And the kind of thing they were suggesting was kind of maybe not what we would have expected in that context. But in some other context, it would have seemed perfectly normal. Because they assumed that Jesus wanted greater crowds, that he would have wanted greater support. They seemed to believe that he had some ability to perform miracles, and therefore their thinking is, well, if you want to get something going here, you need to get the people behind you. But they didn't believe that he was who he indeed said he was. They encouraged him to promote himself as one would if one had a particular group that you were trying to get off the ground, or some particular sect or whatever. God's plan for Jesus' exaltation was different than theirs. God's plan was going to involve him going to the cross, not just getting some publicity and getting people excited about who he is, even if they don't understand fully who he was. It's difficult to tell if these brothers, when they were making these statements, if they were sincere or whether they were sort of sarcastic in what they were saying. Perhaps some were sincere and others were sarcastic. It's hard to say, hard to tell. But one of the things that we do notice here is that familiarity with Jesus does not guarantee faith in him. They certainly were familiar with him. They essentially grew up with him. And they may have been tired of hearing Mary say to him, or to them, "Why can't you be like Jesus?" Well, we imagine that anyway. And two of these half-brothers were James and Jude, who later became believers and wrote the New Testament books that bear their names, James and Jude, referred to in Acts 1:14, 1 Corinthians 15:7. So, I kind of come away from this thinking, well, hey, maybe we should be encouraged that even Jesus had to deal with family members that didn't believe. And if he did, then maybe there's hope, because they eventually did, at least some of them, after his resurrection in particular. So we shouldn't lose hope if there's initial resistance, but continue to press on. Looking at verses 6 through 9, then Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its works are evil." There's a resistance. "You go up to this feast. I am not going up to this, not yet going up to this feast, for my time has not yet come, not yet fully come." When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. So here we see there's a timing issue. Sometimes timing is a more definitive factor. And we can keep that in mind even in the context of when you're trying to share with family members, timing can be important. When is a good time to do that? And sometimes we have to be patient, and it takes a while. Jesus indicated that his timetable was not the same as theirs. They were free to go anytime they didn't have anything restraining them from going. They could go ahead and go. But he was following his father's time frame. He didn't use those particular words, but that seems to be what is in view. The time reference here is probably more focused on travel timing and maybe not directly on his crucifixion time frame, but that is also relevant. We note that because the Greek word that's used here referring to when the hour is referred to the timing of his death and resurrection, so those things that were coming, it's a different word that's used. It's ora instead of kairos. And here kairos is used, so and later when that word is used, it's sort of indicative of which issue was in view. But these brothers were free to go when they wanted. They were not like the Blues Brothers on a mission from God. But Jesus was. He was formally on a mission from God. In the short term, the issue of traveling, in the long term, his ultimate substitutionary sacrifice for sin. Jesus indicated why the timing was a concern to him. The opposition resisted the truth of his convicting message. That's one of the interesting things we recognized before about the Bible. It tells it like it is. It tells us what's wrong with us. And Jesus didn't hesitate to communicate the deficiencies of people. And Scripture does the same. So the world, including any unbelievers, resists Jesus because his message is personally convicting. He tells them that they are essentially following the evil one, if not acting with evil actions or inclinations. And that resistance often devolves into hate. And the level of hate for Jesus has not declined in our time. As a matter of fact, if anything, it's intensified. And we see it all around us. And it's disconcerting. But we come back to this and see, well, Jesus was telling us this is the way it is. Because if you stand for what's right and good, then you are not going to be appreciated when you call sin, sin. And that's where we are in our world today. The timing of his arrival could affect his reception. And therefore, Jesus urged his brothers to go on and go ahead onto Jerusalem and not to wait for him. Probably because the opposition in Jerusalem would likely have been watching for him with the regular arrival of the crowds of pilgrims that would be coming. But if he delayed a bit, he might be able to slip into town and have less or maybe no notice. So he remained in Galilee a little bit longer in order to have some proper timing. And if he's not with his brothers, that might also have been a tip-off had he been with them. So this may have been an advantage. So the timing is important, partly because the details of his sacrificial offering had not yet been put in place. He was going to go to Jerusalem. He was going to give his life, but it wasn't now. It wasn't yet. So that, again, is important to recognize. So a premature lynching could be avoided by carefully calculating the timing and engaging in some evasive procedures, which would have been part of his plan as well. The confrontation regarding Jesus at the feast. Verses 10 through 13. But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, "Where is he?" And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, he is good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Now, who's in view here? The fear of the Jews. They were all Jewish, or for the most part were. That was in John's reference, it would have been those officials and those that were aligned with the leaders in the city. People commonly have mixed reactions to Jesus. That perhaps is an understatement. Jesus is a lightning rod, as Paul was. I thought about making a comparable analogy to someone of more recent time, but I'm going to let that go. You can think of others who are lightning rods in our world today. People have really strong feelings one way or another. Not too many are somewhere in between. Jesus made an initially covert visit to the feast. Sometime after his brothers left for Jerusalem, Jesus also went up to the feast. He was concerned to keep his presence veiled at least for a time because he was intentionally trying to avoid trouble, premature taking of him before his time. And so he didn't particularly herald his arrival with great publicity as his brothers had recommended that he do, but he did it without fanfare to avoid a premature arrest, which was going to be coming eventually, but not yet. Before his presence was known, people spoke about Jesus, and they had different reactions. Some spoke of him positively, thinking, this may be the one we're looking for. In some way, he does good. And others said, no, he's deceiving the people. He's not following what the other leaders have said. But the common people didn't converse openly about it because of the fear of the Jewish leaders, because there had been a strong reaction to him already. Because Jesus was now a controversial subject of conversation, and his presence provoked considerable grumbling. The Greek word for that is gagousmos. It even sounds bad, doesn't it? People are gagousmosing, grumbling. Many of the common people from Judea and the pilgrims from elsewhere debated his ministry, but they tended to do it privately, not right out in the open, because they were concerned about those leaders who were in opposition to him. So obviously there were mixed responses about Jesus, and that's nothing new. It still goes on today. We still have to deal with that. Verses 14 to 18. Now about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? Letters would be like scholarly concepts, grammar, some of those, you know, like you talk about grammar school or something of that nature. Jesus answered and said to them, my doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me. Now, how many times has he mentioned the one who sent him in the previous chapter and here as well? If anyone wills to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine, or the word there is teaching, whether it is from God or whether I speak on my own authority. Am I just making this up? He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. Like he's providing a defense of his teaching and of his existence almost in the process. People commonly misunderstand the teaching of Jesus. Well, we know that's the case. It's been the case, continues to be the case. The teaching of Jesus frequently causes reactions. Some people ignore it. Some people misconstrue it. Some people twist it to their own benefit. Some people respond to it properly and get it right. This text includes the time, halfway through the feast, the location in the temple area, probably in the courtyard, and action, teaching. He was teaching the people. People often react to the content of his messages, as we had seen previously in chapter 6, in the Bread of Life discourse, because they didn't get it. They missed. They should have gotten it, because there was enough that was given there that they should have seen the analogy, but they didn't. But what is the issue that is usually on people's minds on anything that is spoken? Is it authoritative? Is it accurate? Is it true? That was a concern they had as well. Now, we get stuff coming at us all the time, and I don't know if we ask those questions as often as we should. Is it true? Is it right? Is it correct? Is it authoritative? I mean, all the stuff that you get on the internet, emails, Facebook, you know, go down the list. We do well to question some of those things more than perhaps we do. They initially pointed out surprise that he had quality intellectual thought without having had formal theological education. Seems like some other folks a little bit later had the same issue when James and John were interrogated. It was noted that they hadn't been trained. How do these people know these things? How can they say these things? Now, it would have been quite common for Jewish males to be able to read and write, so it wasn't that they were surprised, well, this guy can actually read and write, put two sentences together. There are some people in leadership today who have a hard time with that. You're laughing like you know what I'm talking about. The people do not appear to have expressed amazement at Jesus' ability to basically communicate, but they were amazed at the content that he was giving, and that he hadn't been formally trained under the rabbis, like others would have been. To the Jews, there was only one kind of learning, and that would have been theology. And that the only way that you would have gotten that would have been participating in the schools of the rabbis, where you would have been working directly under them, like Paul had worked under Gamaliel, as referenced in the book of Acts. It is sometimes true today that unschooled people in various walks of life get ahead of others who have lesser gifts that have more training. So training in and of itself isn't exactly the answer, though you wouldn't know that in some environments. So it's not an argument against education. It's just saying it takes more than education. And in this case, Jesus had authority because of where he came from, who he was as the Messiah, and we also can recognize that we have something that is beyond education as well as believers, because we have the Holy Spirit. And that puts us in a place of being able to discern truth more effectively than those who do not have that. Jesus indicated that his teaching did not originate with him. Jesus responded by explaining that his knowledge had come from the one who had sent him. That's again referring to God the Father, going back to places like John 5:19 to 30 and the previous chapter as well, where it's referenced many times. He indicated that his teaching did not come from himself. He meant that this was not knowledge that he had dreamed up, or that he had arrived at through his own independent study. He didn't look to the rabbis to say, you know, rabbi this, rabbi that, Rabbi Gamaliel, like Paul had referenced in his experience. That would have been an authoritative source that he could have gone back to, but he didn't do that. He didn't say, you didn't need to listen to me because I was trained under the right people. He said, I came from God, the Father. That should be enough. It didn't come from the rabbis. It didn't come from his own self-analysis, but directly from God. That was the authority that he was utilizing, that he had behind him to be able to speak, and therefore they should listen to him, is the emphasis. Jesus further claimed that the key to validating his claim that his teaching came from God was a person's determination to do God's will. If you're submitting yourself to him, that puts you in a better place of being able to be receptive to the truth. But if you are putting your own self analysis, etc., ahead of him, that can get in the way. The normal way that rabbis would have settled debates of such a nature would have been to suggest some other rabbi, or basic discussion. Let's talk this out. Let's have some intellectual analysis and some interaction. But Jesus was saying it's not just communication. There's a moral element here. If you're willing to do God's will, that's a critical factor that needs to be recognized and taken into account. The only condition for understanding the claims of Jesus is faith, and that's taking him at his word, because he has the authority behind him that we should do just that. We should take him at his word. The most important thing, then, is a commitment to follow God's will. Once a person makes that commitment, God begins to convince him or her regarding what is true. We have a basis for coming to that kind of understanding. Another way to think about it is his hearers had raised the question of his competence as a teacher, but he raises the question of their competence as hearers, because you haven't responded appropriately to God himself. And therefore, you're not going to get the things that I am communicating to you that came from God himself. So Jesus was not saying that the accuracy of our understanding is in direct proportion to our submission to God. Some very godly people have held some very erroneous views. So it's not simply that. There are other factors that also determine how accurate our understanding may be. Neither was he saying that if a person happens to do God's will, he or she will automatically understand the origin of Jesus' teaching. His point was that submission to God rather than intellectual analysis is the foundation for understanding truth, particularly the truth of Jesus' teaching. He also indicates that the person who advances his or her original ideas will naturally glorify himself. I mean, if I come up with an idea, I patent it, right? Because I want to get the credit for it. I don't want to share it. I don't want somebody else getting it. It's kind of that idea is what's being communicated here. That may not be someone's basic underlying motive, but it often is, and it often is a result. Also, the one who advances the ideas of another ends up glorifying the other person rather than himself, because you're focusing on that particular person. He's saying that's what he's doing. He's claiming that he is following the Father, and therefore in the process, the Father is going to be glorified. He's not looking to glorify himself. That desire demonstrates his righteousness and made it unthinkable that he would be deceiving the people. So we can all take a lesson from that as we think about the matter of motivation and focus regarding embracing the Lord's teaching and desiring the Father's will. And if you're thinking that I should be getting to the next point right now, you'll have to come back and get that next point another time, because I am going to save that for later, because I have too much more to share and still have time to share in the communion time. So let me just wrap up a couple of thoughts here. In our world today, as it was then, it's common to reject what should be accepted and to accept what should be rejected. Let me say that again. It's common to reject what should be accepted and to accept what should be rejected. That's a pretty big problem that we have going on in our world today. And it applies to basic knowledge as well as to the reception of Jesus as the incarnate Son of God, Messiah, the one whom we receive by faith. We accept by faith that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world, who became our substitute sacrifice on the cross, paying for our sins. And so today we have opportunity to celebrate that gracious provision, because we understand and appreciate who He is and what He has done for us.